of background for us because it's important for us to understand the players in the act and what's going on here. In Isaiah, as you recall, Isaiah is Israel, which is the northern 10 tribes, and Judah, the southern 2 tribes, are going to split off. And they did that right here after Solomon. All right, Sunday mornings we're talking about David. We're here. And then comes Solomon, if you remember, because Solomon rejected the Lord, God said to him, I'm going to divide the kingdom. That's going to be a judgment that's going to come upon you, but it won't. And this, again, I find I shared this with you. It's so interesting that God says, but because of your father David, it's not going to happen. Your kingdom's not going to happen during your time. It's going to happen here between Jeroboam and Rehoboam, and then it divides out. So then you end up with the northern kingdom, 10 tribes, and the southern kingdom. And Isaiah, God is asking him as the prophet, he is primarily speaking to the southern kingdom. So he's down right here. Uzziah, we remember that's chapter 6 of Isaiah. And the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and holy, holy, holy is his name, etc., etc. So that was Uzziah and his son. There was an overlap, you remember, because Uzziah ended up getting leprosy. Why? Yeah, he wanted to offer sacrifices in the temple, and there was a, God says, no, kings and prophets, priests are different, and you're not allowed to do that. And he began to do that, stuck out his, was getting ready to do it, and pronounced judgment. God struck him with leprosy. You get thrown outside the camp, in a sense. And so, so that's why there's this little bit of an overlap. So his son is also ruling in Jerusalem, while Uzziah is banished someplace. During that time. So Isaiah is the prophet who is now speaking. We're dealing with this time frame here. The book of Isaiah, if you've kind of noticed, I mean, we've really made a lot of progress. We're already into chapter 10, right? This semester, facetiously saying. We probably are not going to finish it the end of this month. Lord willing, we'll come back. There's some overlap, so we won't spend as much time in every single chapter. But what happens here is, as we will see, nation of Assyria, not Syria, but Assyria, is going to take the northern tribes off into captivity. It's going to happen at 722 B.C., all right? We're not quite there yet. The southern tribes, the 2 tribes, Judah, they hang around a little bit longer, and it is in 605 B.C. that they are carried off to... Remember Daniel, and where'd he go?
Babylon.
Yes, went to Babylon, all right? So here, and you actually see that there are a couple of kings. 605, they carried off to Babylon. That's a 70-year captivity because they didn't do what God instructed them to do, letting the land go fallow, etc., etc. So that was judgment for 70 years. But they did have a couple of puppet kings on the throne that Nebuchadnezzar had placed there on the throne, all right? So... you see Jehoiakim and Zedekiah are there, and then they end because ultimately everyone's carried up, pretty much everybody's carried up. There's some who are left. And then at the end here in 539, 535-ish, Zerubbabel, if you remember, comes back. They begin rebuilding the temple. The temple is rebuilt. We get down here to Nehemiah. Nehemiah goes back home to Jerusalem and begins rebuilding the wall. So the temple has been rebuilt, but it's not like its former glory. And so when Nehemiah goes back, they start building the wall. You remember the tension that happens there. So we are kind of in this section right here in the book of Isaiah. Southern tribe, Judah, northern tribe, Israel. And then this is Assyria, all right? I mean, it is absolutely phenomenal. You see this little chunk of land here, that's Judah. And so everything else is Assyria. Assyria is going to come down. They're going to take over the northern tribe. They're hauling them off. And they pretty much disappear. And then the southern tribe will come back. And we'll see pieces of that. The green area, what's it called? You remember, we're taking you back to high school or whatever. You remember what the grain is called in geography? The Fertile Crescent. Okay? The reason being, this is desert. All right, so this is the Fertile Crescent. Abraham, when he started his views over here in Ur of the Chaldees, not everybody, but a lot of Bible scholars believe that the Garden of Eden was down in here. Okay? And so this is where civilization, when God created Adam and Eve, placed them in the garden, that was over in this area, very lush, very fertile ground. All right? Ur of the Chaldees is over in this area. And then when God calls Abraham, we don't know how he did that, but that's pretty amazing because he's the only one that's sensitive to the things of God. Then he transpires all the way over and ends up here in Palestine. Okay, so Assyria is the next on the list. All right, following Assyria will be the Babylonian Empire. All right, and so we looked at that. That's 605 when Judah is carried off. They're the next one on the scene. They annihilate, take care of Assyria. They're the next ruling piece on the scene. So it's the Babylonian Empire. The last of the great Assyrian kings was Ashurbanipal. And when he dies, his kingdom starts to disintegrate. His son is fighting to try and keep the throne. And that's why the Assyrian Empire begins to decline. Okay? So, and there's a bunch of fighting back and forth. And so then we end up with the Babylonian Empire under Daniel. And then if you recall, I've got a little slide for this too, but it becomes Medo-Persia. The Medo-Persian Empire, which is a combined. And so these two, Babylonian Empire and the Median Empire, Persian Empire, combine to make a really pretty phenomenal land grab, if you will. So, if you remember Daniel chapter 2, all right, there's a statue, okay? Assyria is up here. We haven't got there as far as Daniel is concerned yet. Daniel starts gold with Babylon, all right? And you notice it decreases in the worth. So Babylon is a very strong nation, and it's the head of gold. And then silver is Media Persia, and in the story in Daniel chapter 2, you know, left arm, right arm. It's a split, kind of a split kingdom. So you've got Media and Persia together. Next on the scene is Greece, Alexander the Great, etc., etc. And then iron is Rome that comes up. And then we have a revived Roman Empire. It's not part of this, but in Daniel 2, remember there's this stone cut out of the mountain that smashes the revived Roman Empire. And that's referring to Jesus during the millennial period, all right, where Jesus establishes his kingdom. So that's just an overview. I'm sure you'd do well on the test with that. So we'll go back a couple because we'll maybe need to hit it. There we go. All right. So now back to Daniel chapter 10, verses 1 through 4. Verses 1 through 4 are really linked pretty tightly to chapter 9. Chapter 9, there's God's speaking to Samaria, if you go back into chapter 9, talking about judgment that's coming. And as we go through the book of Daniel, we see almost like a chapter of judgment and a chapter of hope. Chapter of judgment, chapter of hope. And so chapter 10 is a judgment. Chapter 11, we might get there tonight, is a chapter of hope. But it's looking forward, all right? So chapter 10, we pick it up beginning in verse 1. Woe to those who enact evil statutes and to those who constantly record unjust decisions. Let me go back to verse 21 of chapter 9. Manasseh devours Ephraim and Ephraim Manasseh. So Ephraim and Manasseh, they're talking about the Israel, all right? The tribes of Israel are devouring one another. These are supposed to be brother tribes. These are family, and they're destroying one another. And so they're against Judah. So you've got this tension. Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh are the 10 northern, and then Judah are the two southern tribes. And there's this continual battle that's even taking place right now. So we would think that Israel is kind of,
united, but they aren't. Okay? So, in spite of all of his anger, does not turn away. So they're being judged. That's God's anger. But Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh are still fighting Judah, and Ephraim and Manasseh are fighting each other. Okay? So woe to those who enact evil statutes and to those who constantly record unjust decisions so as to deprive the needy of justice and rob the poor of my people rights in order that the widows may be their spoil and that they may plunder the orphans. So God is bringing and talking to Israel, both Ephraim, Manasseh, and Judah, the fact that they are not protecting those who are the most vulnerable. And so his people, the nation of Israel, and I'm using that as a combined terminology at this point, are dealing unjustly. God cares about justice. God cares about justice. And so in this context, he says, you're dealing unjustly. You're not being right. You're not being fair. The needy, you know, you hate that when you go to court, and maybe, I don't know if any of you have ever gone to court with a righteous deal, and somebody who is unjust takes advantage of it, and you have an unjust judge. Those kinds of things occur. God sees it, and he cares about it. They rob the poor of their rights. Again, there's this tendency, instead of helping those who are poor, is to take advantage of them. And we find in other judgments that God gives us, because so often the poor can't buy the best legal defense. What to say? What not to say? But you know, sometimes you see some of these cases, and every, you know, person is by our judgments, are innocent until proven guilty. Now, certainly if somebody is caught, quote-unquote, red-handed, they are normally placed in jail waiting to be tried, all right? But then you take somebody all the evidence points, I mean, they've got the video. Of course, now today with AI and all this, you can do some incredibly stupid stuff. But they're witnesses, firsthand witnesses and all of that, and you listen to some of the defense, and you wonder how in the world can somebody defend someone who has done that. I don't know why. I was looking for something else, and up on my screen on YouTube pops from about 4 months ago. It was the courtroom of Nicholas, the guy who did the shooting down in Florida. Cruz, yeah, Nicholas Cruz, and the defense. The judge actually becomes angry at the defense because of they were pointing fingers at the victims and the parents. And it's like they're the ones who have suffered. And the judge, I got to hand it to her. She called out the defense on that kind of said, you're out of line. You know, we're going to object to it. No. They get the right to be able to speak about the impact of what your client. I realize it's signed by state, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I don't know. We need to be well represented, but if somebody is guilty.
It'd be like trying to defend Hitler.
Pardon?
Like trying to defend Hitler. Or something.
Yeah.
Like
well, and that's interesting. When you look at Scripture, based on two or three witnesses, a witness is an eye, there's no pleading. You know, you go into the court, says, yes. We saw firsthand, and a witness is one who's willing to testify. It isn't, you know, secondhand or, yeah, I saw it, but I'm not going to tell you. And in fact, the Bible, you go back through some of the Leviticus, Deuteronomy, if somebody is a false witness, they can lose their life. So this aspect of righteousness and justice is something that God cares about, and we as people of God need to care about it too. All right, so and then the poor are robbed in order that the widows may be their spoil. They're using the widows to be taken advantage of. Again, in that culture, a widow didn't have anybody to provide for her. In fact, we'll see that, Lord willing, in 2 Samuel chapter 14 this coming Sunday, which is a tough passage. You know, we've hit some really tough stuff. It kind of makes you think about, you know, as the world turns and Dallas and all of those things that we see in modern day was took place back then because humanity hasn't changed all that much. Conniving. But here, a widow who has no means of support. What will you do in the day of punishment and in the devastation which will come from afar? To whom will you flee for your help? God is saying, I'm going to judge this. So who are you going to go to for your help when devastation comes? Because I'm going to judge this. I see this and I don't want this among my people. To whom will you flee for help? To whom will you go? And where will you leave your wealth? Nothing remains but to crouch among the captives on the fall or fall among the slain. In spite of all of his anger, does not turn away and his hand is not stretched out. And so we're dealing with the fact that there's judgment coming for the northern kingdom and there's judgment coming for the southern kingdom. So where are you going to run? To whom are you going to go? All right, so that sets us up. That's verses 1 through 4, that God cares about justice and he cares about righteousness. All right, which means that's important for us as we live our lives too. All right, so then in verses 5 down and following is kind of interesting. Because notice what it says in verse 5, woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hands is my indignation. So what's that telling us? What's that telling us?
Assyria is being used by God.
Assyria is being used by God. You're going to be punished, verses 1 through 4. The ones who are going to do that is Assyria. Again, very atrocities. They had no rules of war. Everything was legal. Everything was right in their eyes. And so it was a rule by intimidation and that kind of thing. And so God says, I'm going to judge you for this. So Assyria is going to come. And if you recall, Assyria did make some inroads into Judah as well, but not as much. And so God says, I'm going to raise up Assyria to judge you. They're the rod and they're the staff. It kind of reminds you of Psalm 23, right? Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Here, this is not going to be a comfort. You know, it's using the picture of what a shepherd would do with a rod and a staff, and it would be to guide sheep. And sometimes, you know, you give them the love pats, and sometimes it's a little harder love pat. But it was to be a means of guidance. And so David, in Psalm 23, your rod and your staff, they comfort me because I know my relationship with you. Here, the rod and the staff is going to be that of judgment. And these aren't going to be little love taps. And so verse 6, I send it against a godless nation. Who's the godless nation?
Israel.
And commission against the people of my fury to capture booty and to seize plunder and to trample them down like mud in the street. Yet it does not so intend, nor does it plan to do so in its heart, but rather in its purpose to destroy and to cut off many nations. Now that's really interesting. Because here's what God is saying. I'm going to use somebody who is antagonistic to me as a tool of mine to discipline my people. Now, God's going to hold Assyria accountable as well because God wanted to use them for discipline. But if you see in verse 7, they weren't interested in just discipline. What are they trying to do in verse 7?
Destroy.
So they wanted to annihilate. God said, no, that wasn't the plan that I had for you. I wanted you to discipline. I didn't want you to annihilate. And I mean, it's interesting. You know, God is superintending all of these things, which he is today, by the way. What we see around us in world events, there is still, as we saw in Isaiah 6, God is still sitting on his throne, not uninterested. But he's not worried. He's not pacing the throne room of heaven. And, you know, we hear the rumblings. Yeah, it's going to be another nuclear war. It's going to be World War III. It's going to be all these things. And yet we know that God has given to us truth. That's not how it ends. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't times of difficulty and hardship. I mean, folks in Ukraine are certainly going through great difficulty, and others. But all of these events, as you know, and then we see China rattling the sword over in the Far East. You know, Taiwan, they want to independent public of, is it called an independent public of China? But anyway, Taiwan, China wants to take it back. And I just saw a headline. I mean, as you know, my parents spent 11 years in the Philippines. And the Filipino president said, you know, if there's a war, we anticipate we're going to be sucked back into it. And we used to have military bases. Subic Bay was Navy, Camp John Hay, and Clark Air Force Base, and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, these rumblings that are going on that we see around us, we don't need to live in fear. Because God is still controlling, and he knows, he's got a plan, and that's not how this ends. But God is using ungodly people to discipline his people. I wonder how many times he's done that in my life, you know? How many times he's used somebody to get my attention that doesn't know Christ? All right, so then we pick it up. Assyria, I wanted to use you to discipline, but you're going too far. For it says, are not my princes all kings? This is Assyria. They're boasting. All right? So, are not all my princes like kings? So, instead of just being a king, they think, and all of our leaders are kingly. Is not Calno like Carchemish, or Hamath or Arpad, and Samaria like Damascus? And as my hands reach to the kingdoms of the idols, this is Assyria. You know, we've spread out. Whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria. Again, in that day, if you conquered another country, then your gods were stronger than the gods that you conquered. Again, you go back, remember Baal and others, Dagon with the Philistines in 1 Samuel. Shall I not do to Jerusalem and her images just as I've done to Samaria and her idols? So this is Assyria saying, our gods are stronger than the gods of Israel, though there is only one God of Israel. But we're going to annihilate Israel, and we're going to demonstrate that we are stronger than the God, and again, small g, for Assyria, of Israel. So we're going to make it known that we're leading. Verse 12, so it will be that when the Lord has completed all of his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. So what's verse 12 saying? When God has completed his work, when is God going to complete his work? What is that referring to? It's within the context of chapter 10.
When he punishes Israel?
When he's done with the punishment on Israel, then he's going to deal with Assyria. You know, so, I mean, it's amazing to think that through, isn't it? God says, okay, I'm going to discipline my people. I'm going to use somebody who's more sinful than they are to discipline them. They're going to go too far, so then I'm going to discipline those who are going too far. You know, I mean, it's an interesting perspective of seeing how God functions behind the scenes. Verse 13, for he said, by the power of my hand and by my wisdom I did this, and I have understanding, and I remove the boundaries of the people, and I plundered their treasures. Who's speaking in verse 13? It says, for he has said. To whom does the he refer to? That would be an option. Yeah, I think it's the king of Assyria. You see verse 12, the king of Assyria, closest antecedent to that, is saying, the king of Assyria is saying, I have done this. It isn't saying God has allowed me to do this. It's I have done this with my own power. You know, God seems to have not take lightly those who are prideful on their own accomplishments. Right? Is this not great? Remember Nebuchadnezzar. And we're not quite to where he is yet in the timeline, but in Daniel, when you get down a little bit farther, Nebuchadnezzar, is this not great Babylon that I have built? And what happened? He goes out and eats grass for like 7 years. You know, and Daniel had warned him. Remember, there was a dream. Because the king had the dream. And he called Daniel, and, you know, what does this mean? Daniel says, it means you're going to go out and eat grass like an ox. They use a fancy word, boanthropy. Bo, I guess, from the cow kind of thing. And so Nebuchadnezzar kind of tones it down for a while. And then he gets out in Babylon, his walk. And it was a beautiful city. Hanging Gardens, you know, one of the seven wonders of the world that he built for one of his wives. It was a beautiful city. So I suspect he was out there on one of the gorgeous Sunday, gorgeous morning, not necessarily Sunday. I don't know where that came from. That just Sunday's out, you know. But, you know, a sunny day is what I meant to say, you know. And the sun's coming up and it reflects off. And they had tile on the, glazed tile on the gate going into Babylon. It was blue and I mean, it's just an absolutely gorgeous city from what we've seen that's from archaeology. And so Daniel had warned him in one day, he said, man, I've done a great job. I'm impressed myself. And God said, that's it. He goes out and begins to eat grass for 7 years. And then he comes back and he says, oh, by the way, I'm putting out a new edict. You got to worship the God of Daniel. No kidding. No kidding. Gets his attention, right? So Assyria. I have understanding top of, it's still again verse 13. And like a mighty man, I brought down their inhabitants, and my hand reached to the riches of the peoples like a nest. And as one gathers abandoned eggs, I did. You know, you go into, and nobody's around, the hen isn't there, so you're able to take them. And he said, you know, that's kind of what I did. I could do whatever I wanted to with Israel. And there was no one that flapped his wings or opened its beak or chirped. They couldn't stop me. King of Assyria. And then beginning in 15, God has a response to that. And God says, is the axe to boast itself over the one who chops with it? Is the saw to exalt itself over the one who wields it? That would be like a club wielding those who lift it, or like a rod lifting him who is not wood. So what's God saying? I'm the one behind it, right? Does an axe boat, you know, you go out to chop firewood, the axe, and say, look at all the firewood I chopped. Right. It just sits there until somebody picks it up and starts chopping with it. And God says, that you're just a tool. I'm using you. The saw doesn't exalt itself. Look at what I, no, unless somebody works it, it doesn't do anything. And so it says the last part of verse 15, it would be like the club wielding itself or the rod doing its thing. So verse 16, therefore the Lord, the God of hosts, will send a wasting disease among his stout warriors. And so there's going to come a time that God is going to bring judgment upon the Assyrians. Verse 16, the Lord of hosts will send a wasting disease, and under the glory of his fire will be kindled like a burning flame. And the light of Israel become a fire, and its Holy One a flame. In other words, God is not finished with Israel yet. He is going to do something to accomplish his purpose. And it will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in a single day, and it will destroy the glory of his forest and the fruitful garden. God's going to have a response to us, Syria. The rest of the trees of the forest will be so small in number that a child could write them down. So God's going to come back and deal with Assyria. Now let me hold on for there a moment. Keep your place here. Go to 2 Kings chapter 19. Second Kings 19, Let me see, where should we pick up? All right, so this, in verses 29 down through verse 33, God is saying, I'm going to defend my city of Jerusalem, all right? And so in verse, and then verse 34 of 2 Kings 19, all right? Assyria has surrounded Jerusalem, all right? So this is almost a fulfillment kind of this thing. I will defend this city, says the Lord, to save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. So I'm going to protect Jerusalem. Then it happened, verse 35, then it happened that night that the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when the men rose early the next morning, behold, all of them were dead. Now, I find that an interesting phrase. The next morning when they all got up, they were dead. Well, it's not quite exactly how it reads, but it, you know, that's why I check the obituaries every Sunday morning to see if I'm there. No, really. But that's what God did. He sent an angel, you know, the Assyrians who thought they were so mighty and so strong, and God just sends an angel through and he wipes 185,000 out one night. And so Sennacherib, who is the king of Assyria, verse 36, departed and returned home and lived in Nineveh. That was a tremendous defeat. He lost his army. God was doing what God said he would do. And it came about as he was... And there's so much intrigue that went on in the palaces in those days. And so, verse 37, it came about as he was worshiping the house of Nishrak, his god, that Adramek and Sharazar killed him with a sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat. It's kind of up around Turkey area. And Esarhaddon and his son became king in his place. And so, you know this, because he the king died, then there begins turmoil again. And so what we see when God says, I'm going to judge and I'm going to work, judgment is coming. All right? So verse 20 of back in Isaiah chapter 10. It will come about in that day when a remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them, but will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. A remnant will return to the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For the, verse 22, for though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant will return. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness, complete destruction. That's all right. So we're dealing with Judah. There is the edict given that, again, this 70 years, 605 B.C., they're taken off into captivity. They're there for 70 years, and there's only a remnant that comes back. All right? But it will continue to remain, and it's a small remnant, but it's absolutely necessary because ultimately Jerusalem needs to continue to exist because Jesus comes from the tribe of Judah, from the line of David, and so... Although the northern kingdom, we don't know where they are. There are still those who claim to be of the tribe of Judah, etc. Now, at some point in time, God is going to reunite because we're going to have 12 tribes back in Israel during the millennial period. So it's not a problem. But this northern kingdom completely disappears. Southern kingdom, and again, with the institution of the nation of Israel, that God's not done with them yet. And they will continue on into the millennium, because Jesus is going to rule and reign for 1,000 years in Jerusalem, a literal place. So, if you recall our kind of our timeline, man, we are covering a lot of territory. 700 B.C. All right, so Jesus, this is O.T., and we're back in here with Isaiah, all right? Jesus Christ comes, dies on the cross, ascends back into heaven. That's his ascension. And then we're now living during this time here, that church age, all right? That's where we are. During the church age. What comes next? Pardon?
7 years.
rapture. Okay. You're right. Okay. Let's do that. Rapture. Which those who have died in Christ, their souls are brought back with Jesus. Bodies are resurrected, given a new body, glorified body like Jesus has. He's the prototype. Then those who are alive remain. This is 1 Thessalonians 4. Those who are alive and remain go to meet him in the air. All right? So there's this great reunion that happens, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 15, 18, something like that. All right? So rapture of the church. Great reunion. Then what's next? Tribulation. How long is it?
7 years.
All right. Then what happens next? Thousand-year rule and reign of Christ, millennium. Okay? So what needs to happen is the fact that Jerusalem still is in existence. Because Jesus is going to come. You know, we are up here, 2 Corinthians 5, etc., having works evaluated, gold, silver, precious stone, depending on what we do. Not works for salvation, but things that we have done for the kingdom of Christ. We return with Jesus when he comes back, beginning of the millennial period. And so, you have individuals who go into the tribulation who don't know Christ, because all those who know Jesus are taken out. Those who go into the thousand-year rule and reign of Christ are those who have trusted God. They're the saints of the millennial period. We who are alive with Christ come back, and so we're ruling and reigning with Jesus. So those with glorified bodies and those with earthly bodies are here during this time frame. All right? So the thousand-year rule and reign of Christ. So Jerusalem still needs to be in existence. It cannot be annihilated, because Jesus begins his global reign. That's that rock that's cut out of the side of the mountain that dashes all other kingdoms, because Jesus is the king of the universe. It is a theocracy. And that's kind of the good news in chapter 11, which we might struggle to get to tonight. But that's what takes place here. There's a whole transformation. So, dear friends, you and I can put our heads on our pillows at night, knowing that should Jesus come back tonight, now I'm going to go to be with him. But this earth, as we know it, has a life expectancy of at least 1,007 more years. I just saw one of those things, you know, there are a couple of big asteroids about the size of about 3 buses out there. You know, we think they're going to miss us. It's like, yeah, they will. Or they might hit, but it's not going to destroy. We're not going to annihilate everyone with a nuclear bomb. And so, you know, you get 2 or 3, there are movies out there. I've not seen them. I don't need to see them. You know, all that's happened, everybody's destroyed except for 2 or 3 people, and they're trying to figure out now what to do, because it's all, no. Because there's going to be a reconstituted earth. It's going to be different, as we'll see. But the reason this is going to happen is because Jesus, God, is protecting a line of the tribe of Judah, so that Jesus, Messiah, the one, will rule and reign as he promised. Next time, he came the first time in humility, we know. Went to the cross to pay for our sins and our failures. Next time he comes, he's coming as conquering king. And so we get, Revelation speaks of the lion and the lamb, right? All right, this was the lamb aspect. This is the lion aspect. And they're perfectly blended in the person of Jesus Christ. And so this matters. This is 700, you know, this, well, from where we are today, it's about 2,700 years in the past. Because Isaiah is written about 700 BC. But this matters for today. Because all of this is going to happen. And it's dependent upon the fact that God does what he says he will do. Comments, questions? I know I'm not quite done with 10. All right, so there's got to be the remnant. And there was. We get to look back in history and we see there was a remnant. We see that Jerusalem still exists. We see that the Jewish nation still exists. Even though they're not really religious. Most of them aren't religious. Well,
there are a lot of cultural Jews, let me put it that way. And there are religious Jews, but there, and then there are Christian Jews. You know, those are at least three different. You know, the cultural, we're just Jewish and that. And then there are those who are the, you know, the different practicing aspect of Jewish culture, which is primarily Old Testament. And then there are converted Jews. And so there's going to be a remnant. Verse 23. For a complete destruction, one that is decreed, the Lord of hosts will execute in the midst of the Holy Land. And so he does. And Assyria is wiped off the map. And Babylon is the next nation, the next kingdom that is raised up. So we can see that the prophecy happens. You know, that's why when individuals say, well, how do you, you know, I think the Bible is a lot of myths and stories. It's like, how do you prophesy and predict these kinds of things so many years in advance? And again, when you get to the Greek Empire, which is written, you know, Daniel's looking forward to that. And it talks about this goat that is really very fast, and then there are four horns that go because a big horn is broken off immediately. Well, it's Alexander the Great, who dies at 32 years of age as he is expanding his kingdom. And then his kingdom is divided between his four generals, Lysimachus, Seleucus, Ptolemy, and Cassander. Boy, man, that's really dusting off some stuff. You know, Ptolemy was in Egypt. And so that's why individuals say, well, Daniel was written late. It wasn't written early. It was written late. So he's writing about history that happened in the past. No. No. Okay, verse 24. Therefore, the Lord of hosts says, O my people who dwell in Zion, do not fear the Assyrians who strikes you with the rod and lifts up his staff against you the way Egypt did. For in a very little while, my indignation against you will be spent. So don't be afraid of the Assyrians. They're going to come and they're going to judge, but I'm still protecting. I'm still involved. My anger will be directed to their destruction. Now, remember that if you go back to chapter 6, I think. No, it's chapter 7, verse 10. Chapter 7, verse 10. Remember, God says to Ahaz, who is king of Judah, and he says, look, you ask, I'll give you a sign. Whatever you want for a sign, you ask me and I'll give to you because you can trust me. Which is really interesting that God does that. And then Ahaz says to God, I will not ask nor will I test the Lord. It sounds spiritual, but you remember it wasn't. Why was Ahaz not willing to ask God to protect Judah and was not willing? You remember what the reason was?
He would have aligned to Assyria.
Exactly. Ahaz had made a secret alliance with Assyria against Israel, against the northern tribes. So here, when the Lord says, you know, look, don't trust Assyria. Trust me, because Assyria is going to come in and hurt you. I won't. For in a little while, my indignation is gone. Verse 26, and the Lord of hosts will arouse a scourge against him like the slaughter of Midian, the Mount of Horeb, and his staff will be over the sea, and he will lift it up the way he did at Egypt. So God is saying, I'm going to deal with Assyria the way that I dealt with Egypt. And what's that a reference to? Pardon? Exactly. When God freed Israel after 400 years of captivity, of enslavement in Israel, the 10 plagues that came about, and Pharaoh just couldn't get rid of Israel quick enough. Go! Get out of here! And they left, and God decimated Egypt. And God, in essence, says, remember what I did for you back then? I will do for you now. You know, there are times for us, that's really important for us to look back in our lives and see the faithfulness of God. You know, sometimes we hear, you know, don't look back and whatnot. Well, you know, don't get stuck in the past, but look at the faithfulness of God to navigate some of the hard times, the difficult times of life. And we wonder maybe at the time, you know, how's this going to turn out? What's going to happen? And we see God's faithfulness. And we're reminded that God who makes promises to us, I'm never going to leave you and I'm never going to forsake you. That when you walk through the fire, I will be with you. And when you go through the flood, I will be with you. And those are times for us to look back and be reminded of the faithfulness of God. And that's what God is telling the people of Judah. Remember, I was faithful to you. In the mind of the Jewish people, the Exodus would be kind of a big deal. It would be like salvation in a sense, physical salvation. Because God did something absolutely amazing. And so it's remember what I did for you then. And we remember what God has done for us now. And so on to verse 28. And he has come against Aiath and passes Migron and Michmash. He deposited his baggage and they have gone through the pass saying, Geba will be our lodging. Ramah is terrified and Gibeah of Saul has fled. Cry aloud with your voice, O daughter of Galim. Pay attention. And these are cities of Assyria. And God is saying, you know, they're going to be in great distress because I'm going to judge them. Then verse 33, behold, the Lord, the God of the hosts, will lop off the boughs with a terrible crash. Those who are tall in stature will be cut down. Those who are lofty will be abased. And he will cut down the thickets of the forest with an iron axe, and Lebanon will fall by the mighty one. Judgment is going to come. And so it's a reminder to us that what God says, I mean, you know, here, Hebrews 12, whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. I don't like that verse, but it's there and we need it, right? Hebrews chapter 12. Whom the Lord loves, he disciplines and chastens everyone who is one of his kids. And we didn't consider, this is kind of a free translation, we didn't consider it enjoyable at the time. But afterwards it yields forth the fruit of righteousness and holiness and a closer walk with Jesus. And that's what, in essence, what God is doing to his people, the Old Testament, Judah. Secondly, I think another one is that, you know, God can use unbelievers in our lives. Maybe that next time that difficult thing comes from that boss who is just pushing your buttons. What's God trying to teach me? Because God can use. It's interesting, in the book of Daniel, God calls Cyrus his anointed one, which is the word Messiah. Cyrus was not a believer, but he's referred to as God's anointed one because God was going to use Cyrus to send back and to make, you know, give the decree that Israel, that they could go back and rebuild. Joseph, his brothers sure didn't mean it for good, right? First of all, they're going to kill him, and then they end up selling him. And 20-some years later, decades later, Joseph meets his brothers. They don't know who he is. And when Joseph, you know, he just can't get past the emotion of it. That is, you know, that would have been really neat to see. You know, he sits them all at the table according to age. And I think, how does this guy know? Mm-hmm. And then Benjamin, he gives double portion to. You know, it was his full brother. From his mom, gives double portion to, and then Joseph is just struggling. He tells all the Egyptians, and he would look like an Egyptian. He would have had a shaved head, all that, and shaved face. You know, Jewish individuals had beards and whatnot, but not Egyptians. So he looked. They hadn't seen him. They wouldn't expect him to see him. And he's looking at his brothers. And he breaks, get out of here, and he breaks down loud weeping. And he's finally reunited. And they are petrified. Because you remember, he gave them a couple of tests prior to that, you know, putting the cup into Benjamin's bag to see if they would really protect him, like they did not do to him. And he breaks down, and his brothers are petrified. They are now in the presence. You know, all that bowing down. Remember, Star's bowing down, and she's bowing down, and it's all happened. But it's been a circuitous route. You know, often in God's geography, it's not a straight line in our life. Have you ever noticed that? It's a lot of twists and turns. But God is still doing something. It's not that he has forgotten. There is something that Joseph wasn't ready for the second in command as the young kid who's boasting about, you're going to be bound down to me. You don't want to be in that position. brothers are petrified because Joseph has the power of life and death. He could not only put them in prison, he could have them executed. They're petrified. And Joseph's statement, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. That God uses bad things in our lives for his purpose. God does not do bad. The Bible tells us God doesn't sin. He never does bad. But God can use bad experiences. And that's Romans 8, 28, 29, and 30. That God uses those things for good, ultimately, so that we may be more like Jesus. That we can't forget verse 30. That's an important piece. We often stop at 28. God causes all things for good to those who love him. That's not the end of the passage. God gives to us the purpose so that we would learn and grow and be more like Christ. And so in our lives, whether it's other Christians, whether it's events that happen, whether it's even the unsaved person, you're remembering that there's a God who is sitting on his throne. And he's interested in our lives as individuals, just as he was in the life of his people of the Old Testament. As a reminder to us of our faith in a God who never fails. And so I want to encourage us with that. You know, we look at this, and there's a lot. I really was thinking maybe, and I don't think we're going to do in 3 minutes chapter 11. But chapter 11 is really good stuff. It tells us what's going to happen over here. All right? There's a lot of good stuff that happens in the millennium. You're allowed to read ahead. Spoiler alert. You can read ahead if you like. But what God does there to reconstitute what sin has done to us, again, Romans tells us, but God begins to undo some of the curse in the millennial kingdom, which is absolutely amazing. So, comments, questions, four observations before we covered a lot of stuff, I know. Hopefully I didn't leave you too confused.
No. So, when he allows Syria to take over because he said, because he got upset because they were going to destroy him. What interaction did he have with whom, or if he did with whom? Because it doesn't say exactly who in Assyria. You know what I'm saying? It's,
all right.
He knew what kind of a nation they were.
Right.
So that made me think that, was he working with somebody?
Was he whispering to the king? The king wasn't listening? Is that what you...
Yeah.
All right, it's a great question.
I mean,
how should they have known? You know, they God only wanted them to do this, but they're going off and doing this. I guess my answer
were
to...
Were they informed? For some way, how they were informed to go ahead and punish Israel?
I think here's my answer, and I don't have a chapter and a verse for it.
Okay?
I think what it is that God is placed within every human being. There is a God-shaped conscience. Okay? It's not the same as the Holy Spirit word, but there is a sense of what is right and what is wrong. God has built that into us. Okay? And so Assyria should have known where the line was. But they were not interested in just doing... You know, going up to a certain point, they wanted to be as evil as they could, okay? And so they crossed the line of that which would have been considered to be tolerable. You know, we have the Geneva Convention and that kind of stuff. You know, that just kind of crazy stuff. You know, that in war you can only do so many things supposedly and whatnot. But there is a line in which, you know, what does it mean to be human to one another, okay? And God's placed that within us, which is kind of interesting, because the other option is that we're here by chance. It's the Darwinian theory, right? That, you know, the strong survived and you get rid of the weak. Well, there's placed within us the desire to protect the weak. So that can't come from evolution, you know, because it's the survival of the fittest. You get rid of the weak. And so there is placed within us, you know, you see someone who has a need, even a person who is not yet a follower of Jesus, but has a sense of right and wrong that God has placed within us, understands that there is protection that needs to be had. I mean, the Bible talks about, you know, widows and orphans and those who can't protect. So God has placed within us a sense. Now we can the conscience, which again is not the same as the Holy Spirit, but we can sear the conscience. And I think that's what the Assyrians did through their barbarism. You know, they, again, the way that they lived life and they did life and the way they conducted warfare was barbaric. And they, at some point in time, individuals had to be taught to cross those lines. And tragically, we're hearing reports out of Ukraine of some of those things, that are the atrocities that are coming in. And people are being, you know, these soldiers are being pushed to be barbaric. And there are some of them, a number of them are reacting against that. In fact, one of was a commander of some sort here just within the last month, fled from the Russian army and went over to Ukraine. He went AWOL because he said, I can't do the barbaric things they're asking me to do. I have a sense of decency. And I think that's what happened, that there's a sense of decency that God has placed within his conscience. And Assyria went way past. They went barbaric, and they should have known. In order to do that, you had to really step on your conscience. So that's how I would answer that. God wanted to use them here. They went here. Now they're responsible for going here. That makes sense. You got two minutes more. There you go. Hey, thanks for being with us. I'll see you next week, Lord willing.